Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, and we're going big on city politics, Herman Mashaba steps into the battle for Johannesburg's future, Cape Town's mayor defends rates relief and the end to security wall. NSFAS and the gambling board move to curb campus betting, and Netflix drives a global advertising boom in streaming. It's Monday, the 23rd of February. Now, years of coalition instability, infrastructure delay and collapsing confidence have left Johannesburg sputtering. Now, as the ANC falters in the metro, opposition figures are quickly positioning themselves to take control, including the former mayor and Action SA leader Herman Mashaba. He argues that Johannesburg needs decisive leadership, law and order and a pro-business reset. But critics question his coalition track record and also his somewhat confrontational style and whether Action SA has the governing depth to run a complex metro. He joins me on the program now. Herman Mashaba, very warm welcome. Tell me, why do you want the job?
Well, first of all, thank you very much, Jeremy, for the opportunity. I can tell you wanting a job of a mayor is the last job in the world I want. But at the same time, Jeremy, I'm not the kind of person in a democratic dispensation going to sit back and be an armchair critic. I've really done it before. In 2016, I took a tough decision to really enter the political space. Unfortunately, my tenure at the time was disrupted 3 years into office. And South Africans then asked me to start my own political formation. And right now, if I look at what our team is doing in Tshwane, and I said to myself, you know what, if Herman, if it's not you, who? If it's not now, when? And I said, look, while you still have the energy, to give it your best shot. But I was pleased that some of my colleagues made themselves available. But fortunate enough, Senate and our members said, Mashaba, we want you back. Go and finish the unfinished job in the city of Johannesburg.
Herman Mashaba, you do have your critics. Your rhetoric on undocumented migrants has mobilized some voters, but has alarmed others. How do you prevent that stance, your tough stance, from deterring investors who might fear instability or reputational risk?
Jeremy, if there are so-called investors that wants to bring money into our country through sofas and mattresses, they can keep their money anywhere in the world. South Africa is open for business. This country is built at the back of migrants, but we've got the Reserve Bank. If you want to invest money, don't bring it through sofas. Bring it through the Reserve Bank. If you want to come into our country, make sure that you have the necessary the documentation and you come through our proper borders. But if you think you can jump fences, you can bribe for officials to come into our country, we are happy you can keep your money anywhere in your country. Don't bring it to our country because we don't want such investments.
Herman Mashaba, last time you were in office, you promised to clean up hijacked buildings. You promised to restore the Johannesburg CBD. I don't need to tell you that today large parts of the city are in decay. They remain lawless. What happened last time? Why did it fail last time?
Well, Jeremy, let me just remind you, in the 17-18 financial year, through council we passed what is called the Inner City Rejuvenation Plan, which was approved by council. And in the process, by the time I left the city, we had already awarded 154 of those buildings to the private sector to build affordable housing for our people. These companies had committed 32 billion rands of investment in the inner city. They'd committed to build 14,500 housing opportunities. They had committed to provide permanent employment during the construction phase of over 21,000 permanent jobs. Unfortunately, during the time of implementation, that's when the people had secret meetings with the ANC for my removal. And because Jeremy, I'm not the new responsible person. When you, my own party, negotiated with the ANC for my removal, I said this is the last nonsense I made in my life, and I decided to move away. And unfortunately, when I left, they abandoned that project. Now the reason why I'm coming back is that I'm not going to start all over again. I'm going to call for that report, and I'm going to hold officials and politicians accountable for those who actually did not effect that plan. Because it was a council-approved plan, and we've been calling a Section SA with the only political party ever since coming into office, calling for the mayor to bring back that report for implementation. But obviously, because we don't have the majority, they just decide to ignore us.
Herman,
so this time around, if we are given the majority, we're given the mandate to be the in office, I can tell you I'm going to call back that report, and we're going to hold people accountable for those who failed to implement that proposal.
I don't need to tell you that Johannesburg is edging towards fiscal distress if we're not there already. Is the plan to cut headcount, to freeze wage increases, privatize certain functions? What are you going to do in order to bring back some financial stability?
You know, if you'd allow me to just give you, you look at the state of Johannesburg finances as compared to 20 when we took over in 2024. Tony was in a worse situation than Johannesburg. And Johannesburg, in terms of its revenue base, has got a much bigger revenue base than the city of Tony. So turning around the city of Johannesburg, for me, I can't say it's going to be a walk in the park. But Johannesburg, you just need to really put in professional people to collect the money, deal with the issue of corruption. The city of Johannesburg, within a year, I can tell you, you can call any agency that will see the Auditor General, you will see how quickly we will turn the city around. But it's not something that will fix everything in 2 or 5 years' time. I mean, the damage done to the city will take time. But is Johannesburg fixable? I'm totally convinced Johannesburg is fixable.
Is your fight with Helen Zille going to be clean or dirty?
I'm not in business to fight with anyone, but if you want to fight with me, I'll fight with anyone, anytime. I've never been afraid of fights. So if you want to, but I'm not the kind of person who starts fights. But you want to fight with me, I'm ready to fight.
Herman Mashaba from Action SA, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, Cape Town, I read, is to spend around 115 million rand building a wall along parts of the N2. It's a stretch of road that motorists have dubbed the Hell Run because of repeated violent attacks. The city says the wall's going to improve safety and reduce so-called opportunistic crime. Critics are arguing, though, it's not going to fix the root causes of poverty, inequality and spatial division and may simply push crime elsewhere. So my question, is this a smart, data-driven urban safety planning exercise, or maybe just an expensive symbol of a city that is divided? The mayor of Cape Town, Jordan Hill Lewis, a very warm welcome to you. Is there hard data that you can share that proves this intervention will reduce attacks?
Yes, there is. This portion of road is responsible for the great majority of all pedestrian deaths in our entire city because there is currently unrestricted access to a national highway. So even if it saves many lives in pedestrian deaths, it is worth it. But in addition to that, there's also a large number of opportunistic crimes on this roadway because people, again, have unrestricted access. And so criminals can dash into the highway in the middle of peak hour traffic when cars are stood still. Mm. They can conduct their robberies and dash right out of the roadway again, and it's impossible to catch them. So we have to close down unrestricted access to a national highway. That is a very common thing around the world. It's actually already a crime in South Africa to walk and to have access to a national highway, but it is very hard to enforce when there's nothing restricting access. So we plan to fix that.
Your critics say the wall risks becoming a barrier, a symbolic barrier between wealthy motorists and poorer communities.
Well, firstly, the motorists of the N2 are not all wealthy motorists. Of course, there are some that might be going to Somerset West, but there are also many other communities along that highway: Mitchell's Plain, Khayelitsha, Easter River, Blue Downs, Mfuleni, Makassar, the middle-class communities of the Strand and Gordon's Bay. They all use the N2, and it's literally the most used highway in the Western Cape. It's used by everyone from a broad spectrum of Cape Town communities, and they should all be safer. They all deserve to be safer. At the moment, they are not.
And the argument that it simply displaces crime elsewhere?
Well, of course. I mean, I heard in your introduction that it doesn't address the root causes of crime, but that is outside of the scope for any one project to address all of the root causes of crime. There have to be a multiplicity of interventions in our society. A faster growing economy is the most important way to address the root causes of crime. Much better police, much better investigations, better criminal justice system, better education system. I mean, I could go on and on about all of the other root causes of crime. But the fact is, you also have to, while you're working on those other things, address some of the most severe symptoms. You can't just ignore the symptoms and say, we'll eventually these symptoms will go away when in 10 years' time or 20 years' time we get progress on the root causes. We have to address both now, and that is what we are doing.
Are there specific metrics for success, and are you committing publicly to reporting on whether the attacks decline?
Absolutely. We record every single criminal incident and, of course, pedestrian death that happens on that road, and we publish that data. There have been 2,800 such incidents in the last 2 years or so, a very, very high number. And so we'll obviously the metric of success is to see that number reduced dramatically. Now, it has already reduced somewhat because in October we took a decision again to deploy 45 dedicated patrol officers to the N2, and they patrol that road 24/7. We've seen quite a significant drop off, but still we see incidents happening, and so we want to see that drop off even faster.
Mayor, let me pivot to your property relief announcement. You're lowering the rate in Rand by 10.2%, but overall,
yes,
property values have jumped more than 16%. For many homeowners, correct, and this is the argument, it still means paying more. Isn't this just less of a tax cut and more of a recalibration, maybe, to prevent political backlash?
No, I mean, it is a tax cut. Quite literally, we are cutting the rate at which we tax properties in Cape Town because there has been such strong value growth that we can raise the same revenue from our properties from a lower tax rate. So that is a good thing. But of course, what you say is partly right in that some parts of the city have experienced extraordinary value growth, far, far more than the 10.2% that we are cutting. And so they will still feel that increase in rates. And we've tried our best to shield them by proposing this reduction in the tax rate of 10.2% and by increasing the tax-free, the rates-free portion of properties to 500,000 rand and increasing the threshold at which that applies all the way up to properties of 8 million rand in value and below. So we really have tried a number of ways to shield people from having to pay more. And our modeling of all 1.1 million of our bills shows that 60% of customers in the city will pay no more or will actually see a small reduction in their rates account. But that, we must say, there is a caveat. That means that there are those who will still see an increase based on the increased value of their property.
Let me finish with a party political question. Mayor, how confident are you of winning the DA's leadership race?
Well, the DA has an internal rule that I can only start talking about that on Friday, this Friday, the 27th of February. So you can ask me that question on Friday, I'm afraid, but not today.
Mayor of Cape Town, Jordan Hill-Lewis, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you'll know that Nesfas money is meant to pay for books, for food and for accommodation and not betting slips. But there's a growing concern that a surge in online gambling, particularly on illegal platforms, is pulling students into debt and distraction. Now, the National Student Financial Aid Scheme and the National Gambling Board have announced a formal partnership to curb what they describe as rising gambling exposure on campuses. I'm in conversation now with the Acting Chief Executive Officer of the National Gambling Board, Lungile Dukwana. A very warm welcome to you. Maybe give us the scope, if you can. How big a problem is this really? Really, do you have hard data showing how Nesfas funds are being used for gambling?
Well, from our own studies that we normally do, the research that we did, we did get an indication that there are a few students that are actually using their Nesfas money, I think that's one, to actually gamble, which made sense to us because we know that the students are the ones that have the most digital advancement in terms of smartphones that they have access to online. So it made a lot of sense to us that that is the kind of the problem. But also we increasingly got cause of the students that were struggling but had NSFAS provided to them. And we sought to check some of those particular instances. Then we went and engaged with our partner, which is the NSFAS, in order to make sure that we deal with those challenges. Particularly what we wanted to look at was the issue of making sure that we have proper public education that will actually provide them on financial management in the first instance, or financial skills, in the sense that they know that for them to get extra money, they don't have to gamble, because gambling is not meant for extra money. But number two is to provide a sense of a responsible gambling should they choose to gamble, because you'll recall that if you are over 18 in South Africa, you can be able to do whatever you actually mean. So we cannot tell them, we cannot say you cannot gamble, but we must make sure that they have the necessary information to make the decisions, but also understand that the allowances they are given, it's actually the funds that are made to make sure that they have a better life and make sure that they are able to conclude their university life.
At this stage, are you getting ahead of the curve? Are we just talking about a handful of cases, or have we reached the point where we're seeing a widespread pattern across universities and TVET colleges?
There is no specific information that is on that scale that we have done across the universities. But I think the opportunity that we have now, because we'll be sharing information, we'll also be doing those public education, we'll get a wider sense, but we'll also be dealing with the issues that we know that they are in existence as it is. We have seen quite a few cases that the student had indicated to us that they're actually gambling with the money. So we could be able to relatively project to say that is the situation we're facing at universities and TVET colleges that we actually face in South Africa.
Isn't the problem that digital advertising is targeting students increasingly effectively and really just normalizing gambling as part of campus culture? It's become very entrenched.
No, you are correct there, Jeremy, as well. This is one of the biggest contributing factors to the issue, because the issue of the advertising has targeted the students because it's mainly online, so they don't have to struggle to see that advertising on our side. And that is why I think in our previous interview, one of the issues I spoke to you about was the issue of the directive we had issued, but number two, the issue of the norms and standards that are going to be provided to the Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition. Those are some of the areas that we wanted to make sure that we tie up so that we're able to make a bigger impact in relation to some of these aspects. The work around the norms and standard is relatively done with us. I think we just left with the final stage before we actually are able to submit to the minister on that matter, and then it can be a matter that the minister can make a call.
And talking about impact, you would no doubt then support stronger advertising restrictions on gambling during so-called student-heavy digital hours.
Well, we are actually of the view as NGB that we should be restricting advertising especially where it's going to be targeting the vulnerable groups, which includes the students and those ones that are on NSFAS grads and the ones who are younger than 18. So we are of the view that there should be consideration of that. In fact, the Act provides for that. We make sure that there's implementation of those particular aspects of the Act. So there is a framework around those particular issues. That is why I also indicated previously that we worked with the Advertising Regulatory Board so that those standards can be coded in terms of making sure that all of the adverts are complying to those particular standards. So that's the work that we are actually doing on our side in terms of dealing with that. And I think that the nitty-gritty of that is going to come up when the decision is made on how to go about it. But for sure, there should be restrictions on advertising, influencer advertising, and all of those kinds of things. We as NGP, we have not hidden that. We have asked for that. And we think that it's something that should be happening.
The fundamental problem, of course, is that enforcement against illegal online gambling platforms hasn't kept pace with growth, has it?
No, again, Jeremy, you hit the nail on the head. It's one of the major aspects. One of the issues that I had mentioned before as well is the issue of the illegal part of the gambling, illegal online gambling, because as I indicated, we are only doing online sports betting. Now, if you are doing something that is outside that, it remains illegal in South Africa because it's in terms of that particular law. One of the most important things we've picked up is that for NGP and the PLAs, which is a provincial licensing authority, to make an impact on that, one of the most important aspects is collaboration and partnership. And one of the aspects that we're looking at currently is the making sure that we consolidate engagement with ICASA. We're having a meeting around some of those particular aspects, but also we work together with the ISPs, which is the internet service providers, in order to do that. We had a meeting, I think, the week before last, where we were discussing some of those. We'll be having a joint workshop to streamline some of those particular aspects to make sure that we can make the biggest impact that we can have. So if you want to defeat anything that is about illegal online gambling and the advertising that goes with it, you need to make sure that there's stronger collaboration between the agencies of government, the private sector, and everybody. Because if you look at this illegal online gambling, where these transactions happen, it's in the banking sector because they have to go through the banking sector. Unfortunately, I think the banking sector is coming on board. We have signed another MOU with a sub-RIC currently in order to deal with that particular aspect. There's one or two other MOUs that are outstanding that we need to sign. Then we tie the matter up. We are able to have a proper functioning system that can be able that we protect those people who are not supposed to be gambling, and we don't make gambling easily accessible because our act is specific that what we must do, we must make sure that there is not overstimulation of society on gambling. It's simply a recreational activity.
I understand that you're trying to ring fence the problem and bringing all parties together. But do you think that banks and payment platforms are doing enough to block transactions to unlicensed gambling sites?
I think that, Jeremy, surely there is more we can do if we're working together on this specific aspect, because there is no one who can transact without going through a banking system. So we need each other in terms of making sure that there's compliance to law. Our fascination is to make sure that we are compliant to the laws of the country, and all of us, all of the sectors are responsible for that. And NGP has a responsibility of championing that particular partnership to make sure that we close all of the gaps that we are able to see. That's the work that we are doing. On the enforcement side, there's even a requirement to work with the SAPS, who are doing joint operations with the SAPS when we are doing raids in the various provinces, whether it's in KwaZulu-Natal, Limpopo, Northern Cape, all of those provinces. We work together with the police, and there's more that we can do to make sure that there is a better outcomes that we experience.
Thank you very much indeed. The Acting Chief Executive Officer of the National Gambling Board, Lungile Dukwana.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
On to media now, and Netflix is no longer just a streaming giant. It's rapidly becoming an advertising powerhouse. New forecasts suggest it could capture nearly 10% of global connected TV ad spend within the next year. That is impressive. It's staggering. With revenue expected to double to $3 billion in 2026. Also, live sports, gaming, brand integration, all part of a structural shift, I think, in how media money is flowing. From the World Advertising Research Council, I'm in conversation now with Head of Content, Alex Brownsell, who's going to talk a little bit more about the study study and the numbers. Alex, nearly 10%, and welcome to you, of global CTV ad spend. Is this momentum, do you think, or simply big market dominance in the making?
Hi, Jeremy. Well, these are definitely impressive numbers for a business. I think it was, you know, it's very established in its field in the entertainment world, but is a relative newcomer to advertising. It only introduced an ad tier in 2022 and did so perhaps slightly hesitantly in partnership with Microsoft. In the last couple of years, what we've seen is a real ramping up of its efforts in-house as well around advertising. And I think that for advertisers, there's two key points here. The first is scale. The most recent figures that they published is 325 million paid memberships. And the ad tier, the advertising tier, where viewers do see adverts, now accounts for nearly half of all new signups. So they are building up an advertising audience, which, if you are an advertiser and you're buying TV ads, you're generally doing that market by market. Mm. Netflix is a global play. The second point, I think, is that sort of trust factor. Netflix, as you know, we all know, it's a highly quality experience, the high quality content. It's a premium environment. They've been quite innovative in some of the formats. And so I think this is why we're seeing brands moving over to Netflix at quite a pace. And the figures that we publish in our most recent report, we partnered with Omdia for some of their forecasting. We expect more than $8 billion in ad revenue by the end of this decade.
Is this an indictment against traditional television, which is perhaps perceived as no longer delivering as optimally as it used to?
I think in some ways it's a vote of confidence in television-like advertising in high-quality environments against premium content with 30-second, 60-second video formats with no interruptions, for instance. What Netflix is perhaps able to deliver that some of the sort of TV companies haven't is A, that sort of international global scale, and B, I think some of the digital media tools and buying and audience targeting techniques that we know have been introduced and been popular from the platforms, the likes of Meta and Alphabet. So I think the way to look at Netflix is it's trying to sort of offer advertisers the best of both worlds. It's that quality that we know is effective type of advertising in TV type content, but it's doing so with the mechanisms that have made digital media so popular.
What it's also suggesting, perhaps, is that Netflix is quietly, or maybe not even so quietly, becoming an ad business first and a subscription business second.
We're probably quite a long way from that at the moment. As it stands, advertising is likely to remain a single-digit percentage contributor to its revenue, certainly for the foreseeable future. I think probably a better example would be something like Spotify, which has attempted to grow its advertising business while its ad-free plans have sort of remained the sort of key bulk. But I think it's an important, for Netflix, it's a very important way the business to grow its audience and improve its retention at a lower price point. The key challenge that Netflix itself has admitted that it needs to try and find a way to close the monetization gap between those premium ad-free plans and the advertising-funded plans. But I think that's going to happen as it brings in new advertisers and it diversifies its advertiser pool.
And Alex, what's also fascinating is live sports events entering the mix. And that suggests, does it not, that Netflix now becomes a direct competitor to traditional linear broadcasters like we've never seen before?
I think so. Yeah, those large concurrent audiences that, you know, live events, live sports, for instance, deliver, that's broadcast television's last big chip to play. And Netflix, for having said repeatedly over the years that it has no interest in going in for sport, we've seen that sort of commitment waver in recent years as it's sort of added one-off events, as it's added, you know, I think most recently, for instance, baseball in Japan. We are seeing Netflix see the appeal of having those big moments occur on its platform because brands want to be associated with major moments. I mean, a good example this summer will be the the men's FIFA World Cup are taking place in North America. Netflix doesn't have rights, but what it has done is signed up video podcasts to be screened on its platform, and that allows it to sort of have a share of those moments. And this is, if anything, it's just going to help it to grow its audience.
It's also about audience preference and segmentation, I think. And let's look at Gen Z, for instance, which we know prefers brand integration over that traditional ad spot. What does it say about the future of the 30-second commercial?
I agree. I do think that there is a place for those sorts of brand integrations of advertisers working with Netflix IP. Gen Z, that's something that's been written about a huge amount. They are tend to sort of form these kind of communities around fandom of, you know, particular shows that may occur on Netflix. And as a way of deepening engagement, it is proving increasingly important. These things aren't necessarily hugely scalable. It requires a huge amount of intention from the brand to sort of figure out how to play it. So I wouldn't say that they're going to replace the 30-second TV ad anytime soon. The scalability of that format means that it's always going to remain important for brands, for the media owner as well. But I think that there is an interesting part to play for those sort of IP integrations, definitely.
And just a quick answer, if you have a view, what might it mean for South African broadcasters and streamers who are all competing for shrinking ad budgets?
Netflix is definitely coming to compete for a share of TV ad budgets. So the broadcasters in South Africa are definitely going to have a fight on their hands. We know that the TV market in most markets certainly isn't growing. It's relatively stagnant. Netflix, I think, up to now hasn't necessarily been able to expand the pool of advertisers in the TV market. So it's looking to try and compete with those existing players. So they absolutely need to be on the defensive, I think.
It's no doubt the fight is on. Alex Brownsall, thank you very much indeed. Always enjoy talking to you. Thank you. And that's our program at the start of the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.